AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction.
You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Keeping the dream alive, topping $12 and up again in early trade. Bean meal futures now above $400 per ton. Washington rushing to finish a COVID Christmas surprise. And the elf on the shelf is on the countdown to Santa time. Here on AgriTalk, we've been nothing but nice, just so you know.
Live from Floryless Friday via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, it's our Friday free-for-all. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and the overlord, John Harith himself. And right after the news, Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal's Pork. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now, filling in for Chip, the hot steppa himself, from Ag Day TV, Clinton Griffiths! Welcome back, buddy.
Hey, happy to be here to round out the week with everybody, filling in for Chip here on AgriTalk. Now, if everybody doesn't know, that hot stepper, is a reference to our mixtape that we had in basketball when I was in 7th and 8th grade.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely it is. Here comes the hot stepper. It was a classic. And I think we may have played that all the way through high school. So this week, I played that for my kids. They had never heard it.
Is that right?
I know.
And are we at the point now where they're like, Dad, this is like old time music. Like I remember listening to my parents' music and they would be like, oh, you got to check this out. And they're like, listen, do you want to hear a secret? And it just sounded ancient to me, you know?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they think the same.
Now, which I've got fun. It here written hot steppa. Is it hot steppa?
It is.
Or is it hot steppa?
No, I believe it.
Steppa?
It's steppa. Uh-huh. I believe so. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Davis, we've made it through another week. next week.
Barely.
I know. It's the week leading into Christmas. Obviously, we've had a little bit of good news on the ag front with a solid rally here for soybeans. Now, if you're a feed buyer, the soybean meal situation, you know, we topped that $400 mark per ton today, and that's just a big move. And so, you know, I think meal is up like $7 today. And a lot of that kind of circulating around the situation in Argentina and what's happening with the port strikes. And, I know livestock feeders are going to be looking at that and trying to think, well, what else can we do? What other options are there for us as we start this new year and try to figure out, pencil out some budgets, you know, going ahead?
Yeah.
Why don't we see what's happening in the news today?
Well, Clinton, by the time winter draws to a close, the U.S. economy could be rebounding more swiftly, according to a Wall Street Journal survey. The combination of the number of people who will have already had COVID, plus the millions of Americans who will likely have been vaccinated by the end of the quarter, could start to mitigate the disease's spread. As a result, the Wall Street Journal noted a wide array of service businesses that have borne the brunt of the crisis could see demand return. In addition, more schools will return to in-person learning, freeing time for parents to work. Businesses, seeing where things are heading, will hire and spend in anticipation of customers' return. I'd like to see a date on this, but,
Yeah, and I know we've started the distribution, and we approved another vaccine from Moderna. So,
That's right.
You know, it's only going to pick up some speed here as we kind of move to try to get more people vaccinated. We try to get the economy back up and running. Of course, all of these things take time. And, you know, and I'm with you. I think it's, you know, is it the first quarter? Is it second? Is it 2022?
Right.
You know, I think that will be the challenge that we face.
Well, and did Mike Pence, go ahead, Vice President Mike Pence, get vaccinated today?
He was going to make a very public spectacle of that. There was talk that he would be doing that, I think, today, if not this week.
Well, lawmakers are hustling to get a COVID aid bill and omnibus spending measure done as food stamps and the Paycheck Protection Program present the latest hurdles. This is the same story we've been talking about for like, I don't know, 6 months now. So nothing has really changed, but it appears we're getting closer. We'll hear more from Jim Wiesmeyer on that. The White House is adding China's largest semiconductor manufacturer to an export blacklist, restricting the company's access to high-end technology, according to Reuters. The U.S. is set to add dozens of Chinese companies, including the country's top chip maker, to a trade blacklist today. The move is seen as another action by President Donald Trump to take tough actions on China ahead of the incoming Biden administration. China's foreign ministry warned it would take, quote, necessary measures to protect companies' rights. Not sure what that means.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be part of, you know, we bring in a Biden administration. How are they going to handle some of these issues? Will they roll back a lot of these policies? Will they take 6 months or a year to work through them and have discussions about them? I think that's going to be maybe the thing that most of us watch in agriculture to see how that gets handled and if any of these policies stick.
Well, Josh Fried, the senior vice president of the Climate and Energy Program at the left center think tank Third Way, said Biden's Climate and Energy Department staff picks underscored a new approach to consider climate change in actions across the government, saying, quote, this is a whole of government approach that makes clear Biden will be building climate and clean energy action into every relevant policy and decision. And yeah. Again, we're going to have to flip to Jim Wiesmeyer on this one because I know he's got some thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about a lot about that here coming up with the Free for All here on a Friday. But first, let's bring in Jennifer Scheich, the editor of Farm Journal's Pork. And Jennifer, we've been doing a lot of discussions around outlook for 2021. And from a pork perspective, next year may be a little bit different.
Yeah, you know, I think that we're expecting to see some profitability continue into, you know, the first couple of quarters for sure. But there are quite a few unknowns out there when it comes to, you know, prices of feed and what it's going to cost to raise these hogs next year. And so, you know, I think economists are a little bit skeptical and still unsure. And that's not to mention what's going to happen with exports. You know, we expect to see a good year still with China. But I think we all know that that could change pretty fast, too.
You know, we continue to watch, you know, China trying to rebuild their hog herd after this the outbreak of ASF. How long will it take them? How much feed demand will they need? How big can they grow in a short amount of time? And I think those are some unknowns that we don't know yet. But from an ASF perspective, it almost feels like, Jennifer, we've forgotten about it, but given everything going on with the pandemic.
Well, it certainly has taken a back burner in the news headlines, but I do think it's more important than ever that we keep our eyes on it. I just listened to a podcast the other day with some of the top experts in the country, you know, just sharing that, yes, you know, ASF, you know, maybe some areas it seems a little bit better, but in other areas it's getting worse. And the reality is more and more countries around the world are beginning to just live with it in its endemic state. And so that means the risk just continues to go up for the U.S. because if it just continues to be living out there and we can't find a way to stop it, we're going to be facing that risk of what happens. What happens if it gets into the U.S.? And so, you know, obviously we hope a vaccine comes through, but we know that we're still, you know, years probably away from seeing something like that come to fruition because it's such a complicated virus.
Well, absolutely. It's complicated. And it's something is, I know you've written articles about this and done interviews on it. We just can't take our eye off the ball here.
We really can't. And so, you know, what can we do? I think as producers, it's just critical that you keep looking at your biosecurity protocols and that you keep them as high as you possibly can and continue to look for ways to make it even harder for anything to get onto your farm. And that's going to make us, you know, make the U.S. pork industry more profitable all the way around. You know, the more we keep disease out, the better, not just, you know, regarding foreign animal disease, of course.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's that. And then continuing to try to find ways to make sure that the government knows how important border protection is and how we need that funding to be able to keep those borders safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer Scheich, she's the editor of Farm Journal's Pork. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right back with more AgriTalk and our Friday free-for-all. Stick with us.
Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. But exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we utilize all that corn while ensuring dependable markets right here at home? POET is working hard to increase the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10 to 15%. Nationwide, adoption of E15 would generate almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year, which is the equivalent of nearly doubling corn exports by increasing domestic markets that can't be taken away. That's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unite around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Welcome back to AgriTalk on a Friday. Clinton Griffiths in for Chip Flory today on our Friday free-for-all, where we welcome Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and John Harith just to discuss the goings-on around the country, around the world. And Jim, why don't we start with you and what's going on with this coronavirus relief package? Where do we stand today?
Well, I was telling Brian, you know, Grady from Pro Farmer, he could take the same item we had last week and run it again this week, you know, and about 90% of that, if not more, is correct. We've got some late snags on how much, you know, food and nutrition, you know, funding, you know, food stamps and some PPP issues. But bottom line, it's not a question of if, it's when they do it. And, you know, the, you know, final details, but it looks like $13 billion in ag funding, you know, direct will be in it, $13 billion in, you know, food and nutrition and $10 billion in, you know, broadband funding. It's coming.
And what do we know in what form for agriculture? I mean, are we talking using the CCC again? Are we talking a CFAP 3 payment? Are we talking about food boxes? What are we looking at?
We don't know. That's okay. Why we're waiting on the language. And, you know, some of this could include some surprises on the positive side in the WIP plus, you know, payment update for the remaining 50%, you know, whether or not it's going to be honored in 2020. I think it's going to include some language and, you know, funding for that. That may be tied into the omnibus spending bill, but all this is going to be linked together.
Yeah, John,
is there any,
go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say, is there any loss of political equity for either side based on how long this has taken, or is there just too much happening in the political news game to for this to get that kind of focus?
Well, it goes into the majority of U.S. people who disdain the lack of timeliness on, you know, Washington-based lawmakers. So it just feeds into that. And that's a bipartisan feeling on that one, you know. Okay. But there are heartfelt differences between the political parties right now, where the Republicans want to keep this under $1 trillion and the Democrats keep saying this is just a down payment. Well, I'll guarantee you, if the Republicans keep control of the Senate by only winning at least one of those January 5th open seats in Georgia, you know, both of them, you're going to have a hard time getting another aid package through early in 2021.
And John, we have this tied now to the spending bill and all of that adding to this confusion. And now they're saying, well, we've got standalone spending, you know, bills that we may pass. Talk to us about where that stands.
Well, and it looks like, and Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like we could end up with another short CR if they aren't going to have an omnibus spending bill in place by Monday. As Jim reported, the Office of Management and Budget has said that they won't necessarily start cutting off agencies if it looks like that there is an omnibus spending bill that is going to be in place very soon. So, you know, as Jim noted, this is all tied together. And back to the notion of how this impacts the political parties, the Republicans see this coronavirus relief package as helping their case in Georgia. So they need to get it done to help that January 5th runoff race, or those two January 5th runoff races for the Senate seats in Georgia. While the Democrats see this as their only opportunity to get some of their opportunities or their priorities addressed for a COVID relief plan. So as Jim noted, get the down payment now, and then the Democrats will come back and look to get the rest later on. But I think, Sean, to answer your question, that's what's motivating the two parties in this.
Yeah, like a government shutdown, as they're trying to roll out the vaccine like they are, that just, it just goes over like a lead balloon, I think.
Oh, I think you throw that on top of what's going on with trying to roll out vaccines and everything. And there's already been a couple of reports about, you know, it's happening slower than they thought it would happen. You know, I think you don't want to mix those two things together at this time. Although, you know, the Pfizer vaccine's already been shipped in a lot of cases.
Yeah, but you got Mitch McConnell on record now saying that he wants to get stuff done before the end of the year. That certainly helps the likelihood of a process getting done and not having any sort of shutdown, and also the likelihood of getting a COVID aid package done here in the next week.
Well, didn't he say earlier this week he wasn't going home unless he got a deal? Sorry, Jim.
No, I don't say it. No, Mitch McConnell usually follows through, and that's when most people in this town who've been here a while, when McConnell came out and said they're not leaving until they get a, you know, COVID aid package. You again, it's just not a question of if, it's, you know, when and the details.
Jim, let's talk a little bit about some of the new cabinet picks. We got some news yesterday on EPA and Interior Secretaries. Start with the EPA. What do we know? Who's the pick?
Well, Michael Regan, and he's the top North Carolina Department of Environmental, you know, Quality official, and he was at the EPA under two administrations, Obama's and I think Bush.
Yeah.
And so he's not well known, but he knows Washington. And the farm groups, National Pork Producers Council, gave him kind of a shout out by saying they've worked with him in the past, and he was always had an open door and used science-based reasoning and things like that. The Corn Growers Association this morning came out and said they hope to have an open dialogue because they know the significance of upholding the Renewable Fuel Standard program. But, you know, this overall, when you look at his other cabinet announcements, and most if not all will be approved, it shows a very aggressive climate change agenda throughout the Biden government.
And John, that's something you've been digging into as well, is looking at how all these pieces fit together.
Yeah, it was an interesting pick yesterday. I know you and I initially, we didn't know anything about Michael Regan, so started digging because coming from North Carolina and those pork facility nuisance lawsuits out right there. And, so the NPPC statement this morning was very significant when they came out in support of Michael Regan. And I think the other interesting twist in all of this is now Gina McCarthy, as the domestic environmental policy advisor to the White House. She had a checkered past with agriculture when she was at the EPA, and I think even she would admit that. So it'll be interesting to see how that relationship works as she comes back in an even more prominent position looking at climate issues across all government agencies.
Well, and the pressure on ag associations and ag lobbyists to make sure, knowing that the climate is so important to this government on many of these files, critical for them to work at how is agriculture a part of that plan, how can it be a part of the solution, not just throwing up roadblocks and saying, you know, this is a bad idea, that's a bad idea, but how does agriculture be a part of the solution to give them some wins?
And Jim, I think that is interesting. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think up until the Gina McCarthy announcement, there's been a lot of optimism about agriculture's role in carbon in the new administration, and that there are some opportunities maybe even to make some money in this. But Gina McCarthy's past was she made some statements about that the carrot approach doesn't necessarily move fast enough in what we need to do, especially addressing agriculture. So it'll be interesting to see if she still has that same philosophy coming back into this new administration.
And that should
be concerning. She is somebody indeed to watch. She's a quick-talking person from Massachusetts, and her history shows. Remember, she had a big role in the Waters of the U.S. rule by taking on the Farm Bureau, saying that they should ditch their proposal, and you know what that meant. Mm-hmm. So, I would watch her as an integral force in his climate change rollout.
You know, go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say, I'll tell you what, you want the carrot approach, because the stick approach is exactly what farmers are experiencing in Canada. and significant rises coming on the carbon pricing plan of the government. It's not fun, and it is major cost to farmers across the country. So,
Sean, give us a little,
the carrot.
Sean, give us a little perspective on that. I mean, we've got about a minute and a half here, but let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we've had a carbon tax, I'll call it, because that's how I view it. It's been $25 a ton, and the government last Friday put out a plan where they're going to increase that significantly between now and 2030 to actually $170. And that is significant. If there are not exemptions for things like corn grain drying, I've seen some estimates out of groups like the Grain Farmers of Ontario talking about how that could, your grain drying bill on an average year on an average crop could be like $50 an acre. That's significant. And currently, wow, without exemption, you know, like, yeah, exactly. So who pays that? You can't push that down the line. There's not.
Sean,
you know,
did Canada do that regulatory wise, or did it need your legislature?
Well, we have a majority, right? Or we have a parliamentary system. So it's, if there's a majority in place, they can easily push it through. It's definitely occupying farm groups' time significantly right now to fight this.
Hey, hold on right there, everybody. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side. We have much more to come here on a Friday free-for-all here on AgriTalk. We'll check markets real quick with the folks over at ProFarmer, and then we'll be right back with the crew and the team on a Friday free-for-all.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage, waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues, like climate change. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol nationwide would result in almost 2 billion bushels of new domestic corn demand each year. That means nearly eliminating the need for corn exports by ensuring dependable markets right here at home while driving commodity prices to profitable levels. Biofuels are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture can change the world. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from ProFarmer.
Hey, welcome back. ProFarmer editor Brian Grady joining us. Brian, kind of an interesting start to the day, especially on the soybean side.
Yeah, the story all week has been the soy markets, soybean, soy meal continue to charge higher. That's the case again here mid-morning on Friday. And double-digit gains in the soybean market. We pushed out above those 2016 highs on the weekly continuation chart, so we're now at the highest level since August of 2014 on that chart, and just an explosive move up. South American weather. Some rains are forecast for Argentina today and tomorrow, but it looks like it'll turn hotter and drier moving forward, and also for far southern Brazil, and so that's fundamental support there. China continues to buy U.S. soybeans, and so that's providing additional support. And then you have the ongoing Argentine port strike, and we're now into 10 days, and that's very supportive for the meal market, potentially pushing more demand here to the United States.
That meal market has also been explosive, above $400 a ton. That seems pretty high. I don't know how far we have to go back to see those numbers.
It's quite a move, to be honest with you. And now it probably opens up another at least $20 to $30, $40 of upside risk on that chart. So that's something for livestock producers to keep an eye on.
Real quick, on the livestock side of things, much movement today?
Pretty quiet, actually. The cattle market, we did see some strength in the box beef market yesterday, and a little bit firmer cash cattle trade than what was anticipated, and that's something that the market's been anticipating. So I think that now maybe we got some signs that lows are in place there. Hog market relatively quiet with a slightly firmer tone so far this morning.
All right. Well, we'll continue to keep an eye on it. Thanks so much, Brian. Appreciate you jumping in. We'll be right back with more AgriTalk.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
Hey, welcome back to AgriTalk. Comfortable after the half hour here as we work our way through another episode. I guess they call them episodes in radio. What do you call this? Programs? Another show? Another show? Is that what we call it? It's our Friday free-for-all. We've got the entire team here, Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, John Harith. Hey, before we get too far into it, John, I want to kind of plug your signal-to-noise recording. That's going to happen this afternoon live on social media. It's also be on podcast today over the weekend. You want to give us another update on that?
Yeah, Jim and I will get into the weeds on some of these policy issues, and we love it when people throw us their questions, join the conversation. So 2 o'clock Eastern this afternoon, 1 o'clock Central. Jim, join us at the AgriTalk Facebook page and throw us your questions about what's going on with the stimulus package, the continuing resolution, some of these new appointments, whatever else you want to talk about. We'll chat about it at 1 o'clock Central, 2 o'clock Eastern at the AgriTalk Facebook page.
All right, sounds good.
And John, I hope you give us an update on how you're feeling, because John got the bit of the COVID, right, John?
Yeah, I got hit. Fortunately, not as hard as some folks, but it took me out for a few days. So yeah, we've been do a signal to noise the last couple of weeks. It'll be good to be back.
Yeah, glad you're feeling better, battling back. Going to be back in the seat today. Hey, before the break, we were talking with Sean Haney about carrot versus stick and some of the things going on up in Canada. And Sean, you were talking a little bit about some of those carbon charges. Talk to us. Where did we end that conversation? I think we were talking about drying costs.
Yeah, very expensive, right? And so agriculture is searching for ways to get some exemptions on some of that carbon pricing, that carbon tax. And there's, you know, I just saw a tweet to AgriTalk here from Adam, who is also talking about, hey, you know, look at what's happening up here. It's easy for governments to just tax and regulate at will, and it's easier to take the punishment method than it is to take the carrot method, which is to encourage people to, you know, have conservation in mind. And unfortunately, the Canadian government has taken much more of a stick approach. And you know, like I said, $50 an acre potentially for corn drying when you're looking at $170 a ton. So yeah. I think the U.S. should look north of the border and try to figure out how do we avoid this situation.
So is there a payment for the sequestration? If you're adopting conservation practices, you're getting a carbon payment as well, like a carbon bank is what we've talked quite a bit about here.
No, ag groups have been pushing hard for that. So far, governments on both sides of the aisle have not been willing to go down that road. So I've been watching what's going on with the carbon bank and the potential for it in the U.S. very, very closely, because farm groups here have been pushing for it and have had no success. I just want to correct something I said earlier before the
sure.
break.
Yeah,
I said that there was a majority government in Canada. There is not. But they if it does have to go through the House, the House, they will they'll have enough votes, because the Liberals, who have a minority government, will have the NDP vote, which is even further left party. So fun times here in Canada for farmers.
And Jim, as we've been talking about, you know, the next administration, a very aggressive climate agenda, and we're trying to get our arms around what type of incentive, what kind of options, what things are we looking at here?
Well, and this is also why many like checks and balances government, because the Republicans will put a little governor, if not a big governor, on rollouts of Biden's climate change strategy, what he cannot do from executive orders and the regulatory process. So this is why these Georgia races are very critical. But I've never seen a cabinet in my over 40 years in watching this town in which one issue in this thing, climate change, is filtering through the Treasury Department, the two-tiered level we have, international and domestic, from the climate change, EPA, energy, USDA with Vilsack. That's going to be his new portfolio. So this is a major topic.
Yeah, yeah. John, do we have an update on where those Georgia races stand? Any early polling? I mean, I guess not early. We're getting down to brass tacks here, just a week or two away.
You know, I haven't looked. Jim, I think you've been looking at what some of the Cook political reports been saying about that.
Yes, and they've been very careful because of their House forecast. But they came out, my good friend there, David Wasserman, he had lessons that he learned, and I always like when people admit and learn from, you know, mistakes. But it's really, you know, nobody's going to believe the polls anyway. Now, the Washington Examiner had an article, and they've been fairly accurate on elections. They said one of the candidates on the Democratic side, Warnock, his baggage is putting a risk of weighing down the other Democratic candidate, Ossoff, in the other Georgia, you know, Senate race. So history would at least suggest the Republicans should have relatively high odds of winning at least one, if not both of those races.
Yeah, and that obviously has a big impact on the balance of power. And how much do we think the world will react based on which way that goes? I mean, you know, it did seem like, you know, the stock markets and everything seemed to hold because of a split legislature. Do we expect some fireworks if it goes one way or the other?
Oh, I think if the Democrats were to win both of those races, you would have a significant short term. Whether or not it would be knee jerk and should be bought remains, you know, to be determined. But your taxes would go up for a number of individuals, capital gains taxes, et cetera. And it would be a blank rein for the Biden agenda. So however you feel on that one, it would have markets reactions across the board, not just in the financial markets.
You know, one of the other things we've been watching closely is obviously this vaccine rollout. And John, you did confirm for us that the vice president did get the vaccine today.
Yeah, he got shot this morning.
Got a shot this morning. The other side of that question is, how do you prioritize who gets it? Our meat packing plants and meat packing facilities, will they be pushed to the front of the line here? Do we know yet? And shouldn't we know?
We don't. Yeah, we don't know. And you've seen a lot of individual groups lobbying to be moved up in that priority list. I mean, right now we know that critical care, healthcare workers are at the top of the list, followed by, in many cases, and this is set on a state-by-state level, but in most cases you're seeing nursing home residents and workers being closely behind those primary healthcare workers. But I think an argument can be made that those meatpacking plant workers should be somewhere in the top half of that list because of their importance in the food supply, as we saw earlier this year, and as we saw because of the close working conditions that they have there. And you know, how quickly we saw the COVID spread through some of those meatpacking plants earlier this year, I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that they should be somewhere higher up in that priority list.
Sean, how's
you know, two things on this. CDC has given general recommendations on the distribution, but I think in most cases, this is being left to the states. So in the rural states, this could bring in the very essential workers in the ag sector, especially after USDA came out Thursday and said COVID cases in meatpacking counties were 10 times those in rural counties. So I think they need to get it out there.
Yeah.
Sure. And if you look at the living situations, and if you look at the environment inside the plant, the cool temperatures, the close working conditions, and how it's attached to the supply chain, this to me at the state level is an absolute no brainer. And I think NAMI's NAMI put out a release on this, and I thought they did a great job in the sense that they said, listen, we are not saying that meat workers are at the absolute front of the line. Clearly, healthcare essential workers are at the front, but here's why meat workers need to be in that second tier of people. The same push is happening in Canada. The same situation also exists where it's in the province's control on who gets the priorities. So same sort of situation.
And wasn't there a meat packing facility shut down in Canada today or yesterday?
Yeah, in Guelph, it was a Cargill facility. I'm going off memory. I think there's 68 cases of 1,000 workers. So they said that they are shut down indefinitely. I was a little surprised on the aggressiveness, to be honest, that they completely shut down. Didn't remove some of the workers, but they didn't provide details on that to us when we talked to them. But yes, they are shut down indefinitely. That's the first beef shutdown in quite some time, to be honest with you. So that's making the news here as we get closer to the end of the year.
Yeah, and John, that's kind of what we've seen is that we went through this the early spike, we went through the lull, and now we're back to some spikes here, and then just trying to figure out, okay, well, where do we fit in all of this prevention?
Well, yeah, and there's certainly a general public health interest in vaccinating those meatpacking plant workers, because we have seen in rural areas that's where the concentration of COVID has been. Mm-hmm. So if you can curtail it in those meatpacking plants, you have a benefit to the overall general population of not seeing that spread through those rural areas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for some perspective, rural residents who make up 14% of the U.S. population accounted for almost 30% of the COVID-19 deaths nationwide during the first 3 weeks of October. Mm. And around 100,000 people are employed by meat packers in the 49 rural counties where the industry provides more than 20% of the jobs. So, that's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
And honestly, good job on Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, to really make a show of it and show that, hey, showing some leadership and, hey, you can take this vaccine. It is safe. Look, I'm doing it. I thought they did a good job of publicizing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about trade and get your thoughts on 2021. Hopefully we can turn the page here to another year and, just see if we can't wrap up another week here on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by new Dilaro Complete Fungicide. Dilaro Complete, 3 modes of action for consistent disease control. AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
Hey, welcome back to AgriTalk. Clinton Griffiths in for Chip Flory as we wrap up another Friday free-for-all with the entire team, Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, John Harith. One of the things that we've been talking quite a bit about over the last, 4 years has been trade. And, Jim, I find it fascinating that we're not hearing a lot about it, and the message seems to be we're going to just kind of hold with the status quo for a little bit. Including Lighthizer, who had talked this week about it. They asked him about it, and he said, hey, stick with what we're doing on phase one.
And that will be the case for a while, I think up to 6 months. But, Catherine Tai, who is Biden's nominee for the U.S. Trade Representative, she speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese, and she's got a lot of experience in dealing with China, making sure that they fulfill the terms of, their WTO, mm-hmm. et cetera. So she's not going to be very lenient on China in her post.
Yeah. And John, as we obviously trade has been such a focus, sounds like climate may be the focus going forward here in the next at least a couple of years once we get past COVID, however long that takes. But as we start to have an outlook and start to look ahead to 2021, we had big plans for 2020. When we started in January, we had a whole other idea than what we ended up with. What do you think is on your radar or on the radar for 2021?
As far as trade is concerned?
As far as any of it is concerned.
Well, I guess let's start with trade. I think you just talked about, maybe there's a 6-month lull before you see any action on trade. I think the appointment of Tai for U.S. Trade Representative is a strong signal that they're going to come out of the gate looking at China and looking not only at phase one and enforcing phase one, but, moving forward on some of the intellectual property issues and weaving climate into that. And you're going to see, on the climate front, you're going to see immediate return to the Paris Climate Accord with the administration and John Kerry leading the charge on that and seeking some changes on that as well. And again, as we've discussed, you're going to see climate discussed everywhere in government and pushed everywhere in government. And that isn't necessarily going to be a bad thing for agriculture. There are going to be some opportunities for income off of that for agriculture, and we're already seeing some of that come out in various companies now offering carbon credit programs And I would encourage folks to go back to, I believe it was yesterday's AgriTalk in the morning, a terrific show that Tyne did, looking at some of those carbon credit programs and how that is shaping up for agriculture.
And that's going to be in our next issue of Farm Journal magazine. Should be hitting mailboxes here pretty soon. In fact, looking at some of those carbon things. But, you know, John, I find it interesting. See, that's private versus public, you know, and it's incentive and choice based versus you know being legislated, and those are different, as Sean has you know talked about.
Yeah, and I think there is a sense of optimism in agriculture about that, because in previous forays into managing carbon and carbon releases, there's been a lot more stick used in this. And now there's some optimism that maybe we are going to see more incentive-based, or we're certainly seeing it in the private sector. It'll be interesting to see if that also comes out in government sector. I think, Jim, there's some speculation that we may see some commodity credit corporation money being freed up to use to incentivize carbon capture.
Yeah, I think there could be a debate whether or not they need legislative authority to do so, which I think that they do. But I've learned usually government lawyers go where the cabinet people want it to go. So, you know, we'll see on that. But farmers I've talked with and ranchers, they want any carbon credit program to be voluntary rather than mandatory. They want to make sure that farmers participate in that, as you've already said, and that these trading companies don't see the, you know, vast majority of any income. So that's the things you're going to have to watch out for.
And can we, just going back to what John said earlier about trade, you know, I think he's right on in terms of environmental policy, climate issues, weaving them themselves into trade negotiations. We've seen this in other trade deals the U.S. has not been a part of. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, Canada had it changed to include the word progressive, and a big part of that was trying to push climate details onto the other participants. So this, I think he's hit on exactly what you might see more out of the USTR going forward.
Well, let's hope John Kerry will be a better negotiator in the Paris Club round two, because he gave China a 10-year pass on reaching the goals.
Right.
Yeah. Not going to disagree.
Right. Hey, we've got just a couple minutes left here. And Jim, let's start with you. Outlook 2021 for agriculture. What are your thoughts?
One, everything starts with COVID-19 vaccines. Assuming the distribution is there, we're going to have a much better 2021 from the spring forward. U.S. soybean and corn are going to be in an acreage battle. You could well have, you know, beans in the teens. And corn is going to rally to get those acres. And again, that doesn't mean, you know, happy days are here again, but I think we're going to get far more income from the marketplace rather than the need for CFAP3.
Sean Haney, what do you think?
Well, we've definitely seen the markets go up, so we're figuring out the revenue side of the equation. How quickly does the cost side catch up, and what do we see happen with some of the input side from a pricing perspective, and how do farmers manage that margin, trying to keep it positive?
John Harith, what are your thoughts here?
Much the same. There is an optimism in 2021 that we haven't seen for a while, for all the reasons mentioned, particularly market prices. Now there is concern that market price isn't enough to make up for what the ag sector has gotten from CFAP and MFP. But we will see how that plays out. But I think farmers will be very happy to get income from the marketplace rather than from ad hoc programs.
Jim, what are we watching to see if a deal gets done?
On the aid program?
Yep, that's right.
Just time and let the games play out. I think you should just watch football and not even think about it, because eventually they'll get there, because it's called Christmas. They want to get home.
Yeah, they want to get home for Christmas.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I guess we'll let you all go home and enjoy your Christmas as well. Thank you for joining us on a Friday free-for-all. It's been a pleasure for me to fill in for Chip a couple times this week. I know everybody is out rushing around getting ready for the holiday season, and I want to wish everybody a happy and healthy holiday season, and really look forward to what we can expect in 2021. We had big optimism about 2020. I'm right back there for next year. Merry Christmas, everybody.